Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our guest in this first hour is Nicholson Baker. He's a writer. He is a novelist. He's authored five novels. They include The Mezzanine, Room Temperature, Vox, and The Fermata. He's also written nonfiction and one book that folks might recognize, a book that he published in 2001. The title of that book is Double Fold, and he is known as a result of that book and having talked about the themes as someone who's been very critical of libraries for taking materials like books and newspapers and converting them into some other kind of storage medium and then getting rid of the originals. He's also contributed essays to The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Review of Books, Esquire, and Best American Essays. He has published a new book now that's something of a departure from his earlier writing, and we'll be talking about it this morning in this part of the show. The title of his book is Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. That's the subtitle. And it's his attempt to try to understand the origins of World War II. Now, he says that certainly there are a lot of books about World War II, but he feels that they don't offer much help in trying to understand this war. And when he says understanding, he really says he means more than just knowing that things happened. He says you really have to feel these things, feel them happen, and appreciate the accumulation of mistakes and lost opportunities. He says in writing this book that he hoped to answer a very basic question, and that is, did our fighting the war help anyone who needed help? And he says he believes the answer to that question is no, it didn't. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. It's out now if you want to look at it. And, of course, here as we talk this morning with Nicholson Baker, questions are welcome from listeners. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that you just try to be brief in your questions or comments, and we ask that so that we could keep moving and get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly anybody can join the conversation, and that's great. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana or on the Internet, you can use that number. So one more time, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Baker, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Pleased to be here.
I think that probably some people would say if you look at what was happening, the conditions in Europe particularly, right after World War I, and then you look at global politics in this interwar period, I suppose that there are some people who would argue that there was a certain inevitability to World War II. Would you agree, or would you make the argument that World War II needn't have happened?
Well, I think, if you step way back, these huge convulsions of history have a certain inevitability. But I think that a war that is as disastrous as the Second World War is like an enormous locomotive, and you have to mine the metal from the earth and smelt it and build it and get it full of a head of steam, and then you have to open those doors and it chugs out on the track. And there are many, many, many individual decisions that go into the moment in which the thing has momentum. And so what I wanted to do was to, instead of telling a single story of how the war began, tell a lot of little stories, very, very short stories, each of which involves some moment of decision or of atrocious behavior or of just a speech, so that people would feel that this war was an accumulation of small things rather than one big thing. So I think it was potentially, yes, avoidable, and there were very thoughtful, pragmatic people who were saying there are various ways to head it off.
And just so people can appreciate or understand the form that the book takes, the material that you drew on is all material that was previously published. We're talking about speeches. We're talking about things that people had written in diaries and books that they wrote. And also you've relied very heavily here on newspaper accounts, just what was in the daily newspaper at that time, writing about what was happening from one day to the next, particularly in the lead up to the war. And here, essentially, what we're talking about is a period that begins at the end of World War One and then goes until just the end of 1941, so at the point where the United States enters the war.
That's right. It takes the reader up to the edge of the cliff, because 1942 is really, it's a temporary end, but it felt to the participants like the end of civilization. If you were in Warsaw or really in any zone touched by the war, even London was still ruined by the bombs. This felt like something that had never happened before, a disastrous moment. So I stopped before things got really horrendous. And the surprise to me was, in telling the story of getting to that point, how really awful it was. I mean, it was the part of the war that we think of as the fake war, you know, the war that happened really in the newspaper and in Poland and not with armies, was really a war filled with all kinds of pain. So I think it's worth telling that part of the story as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I found myself, one of the things I found myself thinking about was some reading that I had done back a long time ago, many years back, about the run-up to World War One, and in fact, there was one book in particular, and we talked about it here on the program with the guest, and the thing that stood out in my mind was this feeling that apparently was fairly widespread in Europe before World War One, that people actually found a way to argue that war would be a good thing, that they felt that European society had become soft and decadent, and that war, the experience of the war, would toughen it. And I'm sure that they didn't really appreciate just what that would mean, how many people would die, how destructive it would be. But that there was this notion that maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing. And I wonder to what extent that was still, because a lot of the people who were planning and were in leadership positions going into World War II had come out of World War I, whether that was still something that was somehow operating in people's minds.
Well, I think the interesting thing, yes, is that World War One, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy was Franklin Roosevelt, and he was busy designing destroyers and completely participating in the war effort. And Winston Churchill, of course, was in charge of the British Navy. And then those two enormously powerful World War One figures then become the enormously powerful World War Two figures. So there is a tremendous continuity. But there was also this huge period of peace, and in fact, a tremendous reaction against the First World War, partly because it was a war that used such unthinkably cruel methods. The hunger blockade that continued even after the armistice in the First World War, which was a creation of Winston Churchill's desire to, as he said, treat all of Germany as if it was a beleaguered fortress, caused immense suffering. And I think that everyone had a revulsion of feeling against war, and most of the world was really a pacifist, believing culture in the 20s. And then that changed. So we have to watch the slow evolution of many individual opinions to see how you then get to the point where, once again, the world is really at war in 1939.
I think that of the things that you present in the book, the thing that probably will be most controversial, that people would have most difficulty with, is the picture that you paint of particularly Britain and the United States and the leaders of the two countries, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, and their role in moving toward war. And I think that the conventional sort of narrative that we all have is that that was not something that they wanted it was something that they were pushed into. The United States, it took the attack on Pearl Harbor to get the United States into the war, and that it was their response to Hitler and the Nazis and the threat that they posed, but that it wasn't really something that they wanted. It was something that they were forced into. And you seem to be making the argument that that's not the case. At least it's not so straightforward as that.
Well, I think that one still has to keep very clear and uppermost is that Hitler is the source of the problem. The man had a terrifying fantasy of exterminating an entire group of people, and that was the beginning. That was the bulwark of his faith, was a sort of fanatical, paranoid anti-Semitism and a love of violence and a love of a kind of militarized society that is just utterly repellent. And we can all agree instantly that Hitler was the kind of central beginning bad person. If you're going to use a word like evil, you're going to use it about Hitler and the rest of that crew of Nazis. The question is, how do you respond to somebody who is both mentally ill and incredibly powerful? And what surprised me in piecing together this book is that there were people saying, what we have to do is help the people who are actually suffering escape from Germany and Poland, wherever they are. We have to do that. And those same people who were arguing most strenuously that we have to open our borders, for just a small group of people, like 20,000 German Jewish children, were the same people who were saying a military response to Hitler is going to make everything worse. So that's an interesting fact, is that there was this combination, this desire to help the people who are actually suffering and a desire to avoid a war. And I don't think that story has been sufficiently listened to.
And just to underscore something that also you're right about, there was on the part of the Allies, or at least initially on the part of the British, a deliberate kind of strategy to inflict as much suffering as possible on the civilian populations, particularly of Germany, and perhaps also of those places that Germany took over, with the purpose of, or the hope that if you made life as difficult for these people as possible, then they would essentially rise up. The Germans would rise up against the Nazis, and the people in the occupied countries would rise up against the Nazis.
Yeah.
And that would mean then the British and the French and the Americans and everybody else would not have to get in there militarily directly. At least they wouldn't have to send in troops on the ground, because they were obviously involved in doing aerial bombing.
Yes, I think especially Winston Churchill had World War I very much on his mind. He remembered the horrors of the trenches, and he said that World War II would not be a war in which great armies hurled themselves at each other. It would be a war of the air, and he believed that until experience really proved him wrong, even though he continued to bomb. But so you could say that the pacifists were wrong. You could legitimately conclude that we had to resist Hitler militarily in some way, and still, I think, make a very compelling argument that the way that England resisted Hitler, which was to deliberately choose the idea of a very long, very slow war directed at civilian centers, using hunger as a weapon and nightly aerial terror attacks as a weapon, was not the right military response, and that it actually was a way, unfortunately, of propping up the most extreme parts of German society. If you create terror in a population, the most fanatical elements, the real screamers, the generals, are allowed to be in charge. And I think that's the frightening fact of the beginning of the Second World War, that maybe the British strategy actually was a gift outright to Adolf Hitler. And I don't say any of this. I want to stress this is not something that I say in the book, because I don't think in a fundamental way that I should say it. I think that I want to offer people these moments of information and these little pieces of unhappiness and bits of broken glass, and they can look through it and they can say, I see it all, and yet we should have fought the war, and we should have fought it exactly the way we should have fought it. I will accept that, but I think it's worth at least enriching the kinds of stories that we tell.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nicholson Baker. He's the author of 7 novels, including Vox and the Mezzanine, and 3 works of nonfiction, including Double Fold, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award in 2001. His new book is Human Smoke, the subtitle The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. It's in the bookstore now. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk just a little bit about actually how you came to write the book, because the idea at the beginning, as I understand it, was not to write a book about World War II.
The idea was to write a book about a much smaller subject, which was how the Library of Congress became part of the war effort. And I read many inner office memos and did the kind of research that you do when you're writing an institutional history. And I realized that I had a very primitive question, which is I didn't understand the surrounding context. Why did the war happen? And I couldn't grasp it. I guess I could grasp it in the sense that I think that you mentioned at the outset of in the sense of being able to feel my way through it and see how the West's decisions, although they sounded good, were actually calculated to help the people who were being treated atrociously in Germany and Eastern Europe. I just couldn't see it, and so I thought that it was better to set aside the smaller subject and to take a different kind of look, relying entirely on published sources at this larger question. Almost treat it as if it was something that wasn't simple, but almost look at it primitively. What happened? Who said what in what order? Mm-hmm. And just lay it out.
And then, as you say, people can draw the conclusions that they will. So it certainly seems clear what your conclusions are, but you're not necessarily saying to the readers that they have to agree with you. You could say, as you did, here it is. Here's what people said. Here's what people did. And you can decide from there, did that make sense? And was, in fact, the war justified? As I say, it's pretty clear where you come down on this, but you're not necessarily saying to people who look at the record that they should agree with you.
And the evidence offered in the book is not the kind of evidence, it's not cleaned up evidence, because it's self-contradictory. I wanted it to feel a little bit like it would have felt to a radio listener in 1938, 1939, listening to these things, having to piece it together. You get the morning paper and you get some of it. It's incredible, by the way, what is on the front page of the paper, and you have bits of stories, and you have to make up little theories of causation on the fly, and then say, no, but that's not quite right, because this other thing is true. So there's a certain weighing of evidence and saying who seems trustworthy, who seems believable. It doesn't necessarily make sense in a clean way, because this is too huge a cataclysm to have a single thread. It has a very complicated, messy quality that I think we need to hold on to in order to really understand it.
Yeah. We have a caller here, someone to bring into the conversation, and the caller is here in Champaign County, where we are. So let's do that on line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you if, in looking through the documentations of the time, you found much, and whether you commented on in your book about the boycott of Nazi goods that we don't hear much about because it wasn't successful. It was broken in a number of ways. I've read about it in books by Lenny Brenner and a guy named Black, two different points of view on other ramifications of it. But I'm wondering whether you because it was a pacifist way of trying to affect Nazi Germany. Now, obviously, there's studies about how corporate structures of the Germany and U.S. were interpenetrated quite quite a lot. The economic attempt to was never tried with Japan. In fact, it was rather abrupt. For years, the U.S. was selling pig iron to Japan while it was militarizing and actually attacking China. So U.S. was, you know, militarism was the wealth of the state and the polity, it seems. I'm wondering, that's a broader point, but I'm wondering whether you surveyed this pacifist attempt to do something about Germany contemporaneously.
Well, I did. If I should answer, I did have a. There's a scene in there where, in Madison Square Garden, where the Boycott Germany night was being celebrated, and there's a speech that there was a set of workmen's pliers depicted on a big banner behind the podium that are being used to crush a swastika, and there were slogans on either side saying, I don't know what it was, support the mighty Soviet Union or something, but it was a powerful moment, a jammed auditorium, and Mayor LaGuardia was there. The desire to somehow make a statement against this unbelievably, incomprehensibly state-run kind of anti-Semitic frenzy was running through American culture, and there were many attempts to, there were petitions, and obviously it didn't stop Hitler. So then you're asking, well, what do you do?
Well, I'm asking, what if you looked around to see what kind of things undercut that attempt? Of course, there was the investment I referred to.
And the investments, the investment, especially the interest on the part of American aircraft companies like Curtiss and Lockheed in selling airplanes in the Far East, both to Japan and China, as many as possible, arming any country who would buy them, because the Depression was on and there wasn't much buying going on in the United States. So there was that's another sort of unpleasant fact about the prehistory of the war, was the keen interest on the part of the State Department and American arms manufacturers in supplying what were, in some cases, in the case of Germany and Japan, future enemies. So there's that. I don't know. I think you are bringing to the question of what you do against Germany a very interesting point. Is it how do you respond? Do you respond by sanctions? In the case of Japan, the progressive constrictions that the United States put on Japan, encirclement, and eventually the complete oil embargo, was, in a sense, what pushed Japan into the desperate expedient of a military attack. So it's not all. Sanctions are also a way of signaling disapproval, but they're also a way of provoking rage.
What to do about Germany? The U.S. role in the lead up to the war, which you're presenting, I guess. The U.S. role was partially, you know, as you say, arming, and not letting either short-term profits dictate, or I don't know, keeping China down in the way of arming Japan and counter, you know, the great power polity. So, what I was thinking you were going to be speaking about mainly is U.S. sort of how. The dance was done by both sides,
yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Some way, and that the U.S. complicity in the rearmament of Germany and Japan is primary in that, it seems. It's not spoken of as much as it needs to be. I mean, there's exposés now and again, but all right, well, I'll let someone else have a chance. Thank you.
Well, I think that's that last thing that the caller said was very was important. One of the really startling things is to see someone like Henry Ford, who wrote this horribly anti-Semitic pamphlet, the Eternal Jew, you know, that really helped fuel German anti-Semitism, then come on board as after having been decorated as a hero with a medal from Hitler, he then builds a mile-long plant that builds some tens of thousands of B-24 bombers. So it's just the inversion of once the military option was chosen, the fact that everybody, even really unpleasant right-wing fascistic people, jumped on board maybe leads you to the conclusion that the war was tapping into energies that were not helpful, that was releasing kinds of antipathies that would lead only to greater suffering.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more, you could talk a little bit more about this question of alternatives to the direct military action that we ended up carrying out, and particularly right. in this early phase, right up to the point of the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the entry of the United States
yes.
into the war. You're making the argument that there in this period there might have been alternatives to war that were not considered. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't people who were arguing for things like that.
Yeah.
And I suppose at the same time, there will be people who would continue to make the argument, say, well, there, because of the extreme threat of the Nazis, their military capacity, what it is, their program, there would not have been an alternative. But having said that, what yeah. sort of alternatives were people talking about? Who were the people who were trying to raise their voices and saying, no, there is an alternative here to war?
Well, one of the moments was a man was writing something called a book called Journey Through the War Mind, and he was a pacifist who was now uncertain. And he talked to one of his friends who was a pacifist, and he said, look, the invasion of Poland has happened. Now Hitler is saying he's making peace overtures. You can't say that we should negotiate with this man. He's totally untrustworthy. And his friend said, he may well be untrustworthy. And if we had an armistice, it might well be that Hitler would break his word 2 months down the road or a year down the road and invade another country. But in the meantime, there would have been a state of peace. And what does that allow? That allows the reopening of borders which have been closed during wartime conditions. It would have allowed possibly more moderate elements in Germany who were well aware of Hitler's mental instability and his really tenuous grip on reality. Those elements might have pushed the more extreme Nazis aside. There's just at least the possibility of that. So I think that there were at least two moments, and both of which were moments in which Hitler himself said, I have no designs on the British Empire. I would like peace. Now, he was doing it for his own reasons, which were that he wanted to consolidate the fact that he had finally annexed those parts of Poland. And that was in 1939. And then in 1941, he said again, after having now in possession of all of the continent, he said, let's stop. And I think the very difficult question is right there, because you're then having to allow the fact that Hitler is in control of the entire subcontinent of Eastern Europe and France. Of course, he was in charge of all of that for 5 years anyway. It was just that there was a tremendously bloody war going on, and during that unbelievably bloody war, 6 million Jews were killed. So it couldn't have worked out much worse than it did. And I think that the pacifists were saying a negotiated response gives us a chance for something else to happen. People, hundreds of thousands of people could have escaped, and possibly a different regime could have grown up in Germany. Remember that Hitler is not a perpetual motion machine. He's not a satanic, ever-enduring figure. He's a human being who will die. And I think that sometimes we kind of forget that and figure that he's just, that he is a forever evil force.
Well, did you, you must have thought yourself, wrestled with this question, why was it that the that kind of position that you outline as being one possibility, mm-hmm. An alternative to war, was always the minority position, and that while there were voices, there were individuals, and you bring them in the book, people can read those. Those voices, they always seemed to be few and far between, and much outweighed by the people who would argue that the only way to confront this great menace is with military force.
Yeah. I think that those voices were in the minority, but the point of remembering them and including them in the book is that they actually have things to say that are worth listening to. But the point is that even if a voice of moderation, a voice in favor of negotiation, fails, I think it has a restraining influence. And one of the terrible things that happened, especially in Britain in the Second World War, was the complete shutting down of the possibility of saying anything against the war. There was a tremendous press censorship and self-censorship and harassment of anyone who said things that were in opposition to the war, indirect and direct, and that meant that the country was allowed to slide towards a kind of brutality of expression and act the sliding might not have been quite so far in that direction if there had been more moderating voices. They would still have failed in their desire to stop a war, but they would just soften the savagery. And of course, that was utterly true in Germany. If someone made a pacifist statement in Germany, the man was shot. And so, it's not to say that this was. This is not to say anything about the fundamental savagery of Germany. It's just that here are the allies, the good guys. How do we look at these people and then learn from it so that when we have good guys in the future, they do the right thing, or that there's more chance of their doing the right thing?
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nicholson Baker. He's the author of 7 novels, including Vox and The Mezzanine, and 3 previous works of nonfiction, including Double Fold, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award in 2001. He's also contributed essays to The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, New York Review of Books, Esquire, and Best American Essays. His most recent book, the one that we're talking about this morning, is titled Human Smoke, and the subtitle is The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. And it's a book that looks at the roots of World War II, but it's not a conventional history. He, as he says of himself, he's a novelist, he's not an historian. But what he's done is he has mined the published record, looked at newspapers of the period and other writings, people who were seeing what was going on, and then has chosen bits to present. He presents them in chronological order as places where perhaps things could have gone one way or another. Or at least it gives a picture of how it is that he would argue that the world managed to slip into war. And the book concentrates really on a period between the end of World War I, although not a lot of material here from that period, but basically between the end of World War I and the end of 1941. Not long after the United States enters the war. The book is out now. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's very interesting, and gives you a lot to think about. You might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here, someone in Effingham. This is our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Two questions and a comment. First, a comment. I think what could have become civilization died with the, well, was stillborn with the ancient Greeks from that time to the present. I have a question about the manufacture of aircraft by, I think I heard you say Ford and Curtis, I think, was the other manufacturer. And this is prior to the U.S. going into the, getting into the war. Was that right?
Yeah.
And what was the magnitude of that manufacture and the shipment?
Well, in the case of Ford, the Ford factory at Willow Run was a mile-long, enormously intricate factory that built the B-24 bomber using components that were sub-manufactured at various places around the country. It was, you know, it was one of the most ambitious industrial, and it was taking shape in 1941 before Pearl Harbor. In the case of Curtis, Curtis was very interested in selling airplanes to China, and really, essentially, in the early days of the Chinese Air Force, outfitted them with trainers, and then later on was one of the great suppliers. So, but all of American industry was moved into, put on a war footing, beginning in 1940, before we entered the war. And the reason, the logic was that we had to have what the British kept saying and what Roosevelt believed, we had to have a good 20,000-50,000 airplanes, because that was the way the war was going to be fought. And the only way to do that was to put all of industry into the production of airplanes.
Yes, and a war footing. And then if I understand what I've read about the Lend-Lease to England and the German declaration of war on the U.S., then was a tipping point. Would that be right?
I think that Lend-Lease is a crucially important moment, because it was the moment in which the United States really became a participant in the war, even if not a declared belligerent, still a declared supplier of bombers. And the thing was that anybody looking at these bombers who had any sense knew what they were going to do. They were big machines that held a lot of things that exploded, and they had four engines, and they flew, and they dropped them. And there was no way that that stuff could do anything except attack big targets like railroad marshaling yards in the middle of cities. I mean, the manufacturing effort was an effort aimed at the cities of whatever enemy you had, and not at its armies. It's very hard to bomb an army. It's very easy to bomb a city because a city can't move. So everybody knew what this was about. That's what's so bewildering about it, is that it was a manufacturing effort that, from the beginning, targeted civilians, and it desired to fight the war in this new way.
I have one more comment and question, David, if I can.
Sure.
I hate to run on, but the events prior to World War One and the old idea of what used to be called empire became known as, in our time, as hegemony. And then from prior to World War One, throughout that, then the events of 1917 in Russia, and here was this threat that we had to be friendly with in order to head off what later became the Cold War. And right up to this present day, and here we are, there has been no let-up in war for way over 100 years. and for what motive? And it is capitalism and the hegemonic power that any one given nation can exercise on the rest of the world with their cohorts. You know, England was overthrown as a colonial power in 1960, weakened by both wars, and then the U.S. stepped forward and becomes the superior hegemon in our time. I find the whole subject, I appreciate your work and your books and the things that you are saying, but that overall picture has to be understood, and the reasoning that produced those things and are still producing those things in Iraq and in the threats to Iran and the whole of the Middle East, which have been attacked for 2,000 years by Western entities when they got the power to do so. Thank you very much, and a very good program, Dave.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, I think that theme of empire is worth underlining. I wanted to show in the book how what I found, which interested me, was that the British way of dealing with Germany was an extension of the way they had dealt with recalcitrant tribes in India and in the Sudan and all over the world, where they were in control of a place. They would have this thing called air control, where they would drop leaflets and they would say, you should do what we want you to do, and if you don't, we're going to bomb you. And then they would fly over with a bunch of airplanes and bomb the village. And this happened all the way, and this was the creation of Churchill as Secretary of Air and Secretary of the Colonies. And it was a way of saving money, because the empire was very difficult to police the whole empire. But it was a way of controlling people, making people, they thought, do what you wanted them to do by threatening them from the air. And they thought that this could be extended into something that would work in Germany. But it's a very different thing to bomb a tribe, a village, and to bomb the city of Hamburg or of Berlin and by night. It's just a different thing. And then, of course, it creates hatred. It creates tremendous resentment. And it was totally wrong if they believed that it would incite the citizenry to revolt. It had completely the opposite effect. It incited the citizenry to solidarity with the state, extreme nationalism, and extreme antipathy towards England. And was that the result that we really wanted from a military campaign? I don't think so.
About 5 minutes left in this part of Focus with Nicholson Baker, his most recent book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization, published by Simon & Schuster. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Certainly, I think a lot of people would say that Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill were two of the most important, at least in terms of their impact, most important leaders of the 20th century.
Yes.
Certainly they, after reading the book, I'd say one would start to think differently, perhaps, about them, or at least differently than you had before. Did this, in the process particularly, I'm thinking of Churchill because I think he does not come off well in the book, whether you found yourself, what your thoughts were about Churchill before, or if you had many thoughts about Churchill before, and how that changed in the course of doing this book?
Well, that's a really good question, because I am so impressed. I loved the way Churchill wrote. And I think anybody who reads Churchill's speeches has to be in awe of this man. He was a brilliant speechwriter. He was also a brilliant historian. And who else in history has gotten to lead massive military forces in two gigantic wars and then write the standard works of history after each war? I mean, he is a remarkable, fascinating figure. He is, at this point, I think I'm being fair to this very complicated and fascinating man by portraying him as being in something of a manic phase in which he really wanted to widen the war and he wanted to rouse the citizenry of England. He wanted even to have the Germans bomb a place like Coventry because it would create the rage that he was hoping for. So he's a very interesting, complicated figure, and I don't mean to present a caricature of him because I think, you know, his greatness is unquestionable, but it's just, in some ways you have to say, frankly, he was the worst, absolutely the worst possible person who could be leading the great country of England in a war against Germany. Absolute worst possible choice.
Which, of course, goes up against the idea that I'm sure a lot of people have, is that he was the best to lead England through this dark and terrible period. He was the best person that they could have found.
Yes, and I think that is obviously, that is the dominant way of looking at it, and I doubt very much that my book will do anything to change that. But I think it's at least the dominant view has to interrogate itself with some actual facts. Here's a man, brilliant, well-read, masses of poetry in his head, just an intensely intelligent man, saying that business before pleasure when he was talking about the question of whether you would first bomb civilians or bomb German industry. He was a bloodthirsty man. He was, and there's just no getting around it. And his greatness may survive that, or it won't. But that has to be acknowledged.
I am confident that of those people who might be critical of the book, many of them would be people who made their living as historians. And I'm sure that you have answered this question before, but let me ask it. Mm-hmm. Not being an historian, being someone who has done other kinds of writing, both fiction and nonfiction, but perhaps a lot of people will think of you as a novelist. Do you feel that somehow that kind of background, the kind of writing that you've done, gives you some perspective on this that would be different from that of someone who by their profession, is an historian?
Well, I think it obviously is a weakness because I haven't been living with this material for 20 years, and I hope it's also a strength in that when I read something that happened in Poland, or one of the beautiful diaries, of course, these are the great heroes of the war, Victor Klemperer, Mary Berg in the Warsaw Ghetto, the people who weren't blowing things up and fighting, but were creating some beautiful product of the human mind while all this stuff was going on. Those are the real nonviolent heroes of the war. The fact that when I read those things, I'm reading them for the first time, I think that maybe that naivete, that ability to be shocked just as a human being, could be at least a strength. Mm-hmm. Is that, and also maybe the fact that I'm looking at it as many little stories, little scenes, as opposed to one gigantic story, is something that comes maybe from a fiction writing background. But everything in here is really part of the public record, and I think I would ask for people to actually look at the book before they dismiss some contention about me as being saying something about, let's say, moral equivalence that I would never endorse. Mm-hmm. I just think that it's worth folding into our working knowledge of something this important more specifics, and that's really what I was trying to offer. I always like detail and specifics.
Yeah. There's so many things here in this book that are wonderful, in a sense, that they make you stop and think, and little bits, little pieces of writing. And I guess one of the things that really struck me right off the bat was one of the very first things that you offer here, which comes from an Austrian writer named Stefan Zweig, who talks in his writing about the fact that he happened to be in France in a movie theater watching a newsreel. And on comes the news, to the newsreel comes Wilhelm II. And everybody starts yelling. The place goes nuts. And what he writes in there, and it, to me it's very striking that the, these good-natured people who knew no more about the world and politics than what they read in the newspapers had gone mad for an instant. He says it had only been a second, but one that showed me how easily people anywhere could be aroused in a time of crisis despite all attempts at understanding. And to me, what that it made me start thinking about war, particularly on this the scale that we're talking about, is as a kind of collective insanity, where people just all lose their minds.
Well, I think that's I'm so glad that you got that from that, because I wanted that to be kind of the pitch of the entire book, was that kind of statement from Zweig. Zweig was a person who lived through the First World War as a Jew and came out of it as a pacifist, remained that way, and I think is one of the great voices that we haven't taken into account enough in this in the version of the Second World War that we carry around with us.
Yeah. We're going to have to leave it there. The book is Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization by Simon & Schuster, published by Simon & Schuster by our guest, Nicholson Baker. Mr. Baker, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.